ran everywhere in that big Ohio prison tragedy. Ways to safety were all blocked, many cells were barred and locked, and the raging flames brought death and agony.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On Easter Monday in 1930, a fire trapped hundreds of inmates in the aging Ohio Penitentiary just minutes after they had returned to their cells after a holiday supper. What remains the deadliest prison fire in American history claimed the lives of 320 men. They hailed from every corner of the country and beyond. The tragedy made heroes of some and highlighted the horrifying penal conditions in Depression-era prisons across the country. Mitchell P. Roth is a professor of criminal justice and criminology at Sam Houston State University. His book is titled Fire in the Big House, America's Deadliest Prison Disaster. Mitchell Roth joins us via Skype. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I was interested that the fire occurred at a time when the technology of film really had just was starting to burgeon and kind of made it go viral. That is for the era. How did the nation respond? What happened with the film and how did people learn about this and how did they react?
Well, it was interesting. Well, it's Columbus was so near a lot of the larger cities like Chicago and Cleveland. And so a lot of the information was passed on the film information by using airplanes and using cars. And there was also some new technology that allowed some of the information to be passed on over the telegraph. And, basically the country had become much smaller at that point. And, technology was – this is the first time actually a disaster was covered by all three major forms of the media. It was covered by film. It was covered by the radio, covered by the press. And it's kind of interesting because the fire lasted less than an hour. Mm-hmm. And yet all of this, was covered. You had Pathé News there with film cameras filming it. They were able to get it quickly to the East Coast, at least the East Coast movie theaters.
And that really started to change how people reacted to this kind of news, right? That they could see it in the theaters right before the Mickey Mouse reel.
Yeah. I mean, this was, very important step forward in news technology. The problem was in 1930 and elsewhere, you had the Great Depression, you had Prohibition, you had other things, that were on people's minds. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, they're always looking for, happier stories. But as they say, if it bleeds, it leads. And, this was, not just the worst fire in prison history, but in America, it was the worst disaster period in prison history in America.
Until 2012.
No.
I'm sorry. You're right. In America. Right. And internationally, yeah. Though, it was the worst.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. In Honduras, they kind of, went over that number. They were, I think it was closer to like 360.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the April 1930 fire that trapped hundreds of inmates in the aging Ohio Penitentiary. My guest is Mitchell Roth. He's a professor of criminal justice and criminology at Sam Houston State University. His book is titled Fire in the Big House, America's Deadliest Prison Disaster. Coming up, we'd love to hear your questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mitchell Roth, what were typical conditions at the time, and how did the Ohio Pen measure up to the standards of the day?
Well, most prisons, the Ohio Penitentiary was part of what we call the Big House prisons. It was basically a kind of a warehouse that was overcrowded, underfunded, understaffed. And really, no matter where you have those conditions and when you have those conditions, you have the potential for, disaster. And it just so happens that prisoners were spending longer times in jail. The sentences were much harsher. People were probation was less and parole were less easy to get. And, there was a less power in the judge's hands to, determine, sentences. There was a lot of maximum sentencing like we have today, for instance, mm-hmm. Which began.
So it sounds familiar.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of people think about prison overcrowding just being a modern phenomenon. But, you know, really in 1930, really, we have really the first, you know, major prison overcrowding throughout the United States. And in 1929, you had major riots in a lot of the larger prisons throughout the country, a lot of them on the East Coast. And so, you know, Columbus wasn't a riot, but you had all the conditions for one, and there had been riots there before.
People are often surprised to hear that it was situated, the Ohio Penitentiary, right at the site of the Nationwide Arena in downtown Columbus, what is now downtown Columbus. At the time, it would have been on the outskirts of downtown, but be that as it may, it was still much closer to a city center than we are used to today. Was it typical to have prisons so nearby a city?
Well, what the older prisons, you know, especially like if you think of Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia, these were, you know, major penitentiaries, and they were built in the 19th century when, you know, the cities were, you know, really, you know, just kind of, you know, in their building stages. Mm-hmm. And typically the city usually grew around the prison. The prisons took up so much important space, and they were usually very strategically located. It was you couldn't really put the prison somewhere else or put the city somewhere else. So the city grew up around the prison. And so this was not uncommon.
And at the time, we were talking about how Americans responded. And, of course, you're talking about the Depression. And the Depression was worldwide by that point or soon thereafter. But today, America, you know, the United States imprisons more people total than the rest of the world combined. Was it the same way back then? And what was the reaction internationally, or wasn't there much?
Well, actually, you know, the data is hard to come by for that time period. I mean, it's hard enough finding out the you know, prison populations in some countries today. Back then, it was even harder to find mm-hmm. them. But the United States did have, you know, a reputation for kind of punitive prisons. And of course, this just reinforced it in the minds of others. You know, the world was, you know, really not, we didn't have globalization at that point. And we had some, you know, we didn't have a lot of information on prisons in other countries. I know from studying prisons that you had prison overcrowding in a lot of the countries. And a lot of the countries, you know, were under colonial rule. If we're looking at, for instance, Asia and, you know, parts of Africa and so forth. So we really don't know about that. Mm-hmm. But I think everybody looked at the United States as kind of a, you know, a golden land. And to see this disaster, you know, taking place in America, you know, really, I think, you know, told people that, you know, we're living in a different era. And, you know, it just reinforced people's, I guess, perceptions of America, you know, having a punitive criminal justice system.
How did the fire start?
Well, the fire started, you had two or three guys had been trying to start a fire for about a year. They were basically, there was some building going on in I and K cell blocks, which was next to G and H, which were the ones that were destroyed. And I and K, there was lots of building, you know, building materials. There was wood. And basically they had some, these two guys had candles smuggled to them. They set up a kind of a timer of sorts that would basically light on fire while everybody was at dinner, hypothetically. And they were hoping to use this as a ruse to escape. Of course, they would deny this later on and explain that it was more of a protest than anything else. But anyway, you know, because of the winds at that time and because the fire was lit really next to the only part of the prison that was not fireproof, which was a wooden piece of ceiling that was being basically replaced, but not yet replaced. Mm-hmm. You know, everything that could go wrong, you know, went wrong at that moment. And so the fire did not start until everybody was back in their cells. And the cells were, you know, single lock cells. So it takes a long time to lock everybody in, a long time to let everybody out.
That is if you even try. How did the prison guards respond when the fire broke out?
Well, at that prison, being a prison guard, you know, today is not considered the greatest job in the world. I mean, it's a really tough job
because
you're almost as much a prisoner as the prisoners. But back then, it was a great job during the Depression, and these guys would do anything they could to really keep the job. And so they followed orders to the T, and they knew that they were responsible for keeping the prisoners from breaking out of the cells, and especially, as you mentioned earlier, being in the middle of town, that was always a fear that there would be a mass escape and they would get into town.
Mm-hmm.
So they did not have really the autonomy to, you know, really make decisions. And by the time they reacted, it was too late. And the problem is they'd never done any real, you know, emergency preparation for fires, you know, and they didn't have firefighting equipment or hoses or anything like that that could be used. So, the conditions were just, you know, rife for, for this to take place.
I was surprised to read that there was no fire equipment, that they hadn't done any emergency preparations, because fire was so much of a greater danger back then than it is today.
Yeah, I was surprised, too. And the more I've researched it over the years, I found it's not a whole lot different today. I live in Texas where we have a lot of prisons, and I teach in Huntsville, which has a lot of prisons. And mm-hmm. I've spoken to people that work in these prisons, and really they don't, you know, spend a lot of time on, you know, emergency planning and that sort of thing. Of course, the prisons aren't as crowded as they used to be, and they have new architecture to make them safer. You know, when you think about money being spent on prisons, too, it's usually at the bottom of the list for state legislatures. And, I would put some of the blame on the fire department in Columbus for really not. They were supposed to be taking, making routine accounts of, you know, how well prepared it was. And they really hadn't done any type of preparation.
The prison guards not only didn't have a plan of response, but they actually forced inmates to stay in their cells instead of helping them get out.
Well, you know, that I think in retrospect, I don't think that they intended for anybody to, you know, to die, obviously. I just think that they didn't realize, the danger that smoke has, you know, because basically, everybody died from smoke inhalation. You know,
right.
The fires, burns, and things were post mortem. I think that they were just trying to get, I guess the right information from the heads of the prison to let them out before that they did anything, and they were just worried about losing their jobs.
We are talking about the Ohio Penitentiary Fire. It occurred on Easter Monday in 1930. 320 men were killed in that fire, mostly, as my guest said, from smoke inhalation. My guest is Mitchell Roth. He's a professor of criminal justice and criminology at Sam Houston State University. His book is titled Fire in the Big House, America's Deadliest Prison Disaster. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about the fire that occurred on Easter Monday in 1930. It trapped hundreds of inmates in the Ohio Penitentiary just minutes after they had returned from a supper. It remains the deadliest prison fire in American history. It claimed the lives of 320 men. It made heroes of some and highlighted the horrific penal conditions in Depression-era prisons across the country. But it has been largely forgotten, along with the prison, the site of which is now home to the nationwide arena, trendy condos, and dining venues. Still with us via Skype is professor of criminal justice and criminology at Sam Houston University, Mitchell Roth. His new book is titled Fire in the Big House, America's Deadliest Prison Disaster. What was the role of the warden, Mitchell, in all of this?
Well, the warden basically... I guess you could say that he was often a political appointee, no matter what prison system that you're looking at, not just in Ohio, and he lived right on the prison grounds, basically, or right near the prison grounds, and he was basically the captain of the prison, and all things were supposed to emanate from him. He often he had an assistant warden that would also help him out. But the warden was very concerned with protecting his reputation, and having a good reputation meant that you didn't have prisoners escape from your prison, and everything went according to plans. And the big mistake that the warden made at during the fire was that he went outside the prison to kind of direct the troops coming in, the firemen and everything like that, to control the outside perimeter to make sure people weren't escaping. And so people that were relying on his direction were not really getting any direction from him, and it was kind of like every man for himself to a great extent. And that's, I think, one of the miraculous things about this whole disaster was how everybody basically, worked together, the guards and the prisoners, in order to save a lot of the prisoners.
Right. How did the inmates respond? What happened?
Well, most of the inmates responded by, trying to help out. I mean, you only had one prisoner, in fact, that ended up escaping. I think he put some doctor's garb on and walked out, and that was it. But they got him pretty quickly. But, most of them basically worked with the guards. They worked with each other. Race didn't matter. You had black and white inmates working together. Prisoners are very innovative, and they had to come up with all kinds of ideas on, how to get into the cells, how to bring the bodies out, how to, try and save people, because this was, not within their purview, being a prisoner. And, you had a lot of prisoners from a lot of different backgrounds, from a lot of different countries. And you had a prison kind of that was run according to the convict code. There were no gangs at the time, and pretty much everybody, was in it together.
Tell us a little bit about the prisoners themselves. Did this prison, did it house all levels of crime?
Yes, it did. You had white collar criminals living on what was called a banker's row, which you often find. They're able to pay for better accommodations. You had murderers, you had rapists, but then you had people that just went into prison the day of the fire for not paying child support and died. So you had the whole food chain of inmates in the prison.
And among those who died, was the whole food chain represented?
No, it wasn't. Those that died were basically on the top two tiers of the G and H cell blocks. And these two tiers actually housed the best workers who were working on the neighboring cell blocks. And so later on, it was lamented we lost a lot of our good workers, but they were mostly at the top. So you only really had several tiers that were affected. And remember, it was a very large prison with, over 4,300 inmates.
Yeah.
And so, it was really just a handful of people. I mean, you have 320 inmates die, and there was $11,000 in damage to the prison. Something was, out of kilter there.
Hmm. Yeah, I think about visualize that many people. And I think the dormitory I lived in at Michigan State had 1,200, and that was considered huge at the time. So I'm just thinking about the humanity affected by it. Margaret Ann in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Margaret Ann.
I have had a friend who moved to Columbus by bus the day after the fire, and at that time the bus station was on North High Street, just probably around First Avenue.
Yeah.
And she told me about getting off the bus from Brooklyn and standing there and saying, what is that awful smell? So you just on North High Street, you could smell the rotting bodies.
A lot of bodies. Margaret Ann, thank you for that, I think.
I know, yeah. I
would have liked to have spoken to you before while I was researching the book.
Yeah, I mean, did people, thank you, Margaret Ann, for that. Was it the talk of the town, or how much did people really know about what was going on over there?
Well, everybody pretty much knew what was going on. I mean, it was impossible not to, being right in the middle of town. You know, I don't know if it's hyperbole, but people talk about hearing people screaming from inside the prison, outside the prison. You just don't know whether people misinterpreted the sounds and all. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have this cacophony of noises and it drew the attention of the whole town. I mean, back then there wasn't a lot of entertainment, and so people flocked to disasters just like they do today, you know, the looky-loos. And, they were on top of buildings across the street and so forth.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking to Mitchell Roth. He's a professor of criminal justice and criminology at Sam Houston State University. His new book is titled Fire in the Big House, America's Deadliest Prison Disaster. And why are we not talking about that? Well, because it happened at the Ohio Penitentiary in 1930. And it claimed the lives of 320 men. They hailed from every corner of the country and beyond. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wrote, Mitchell, about the heroic actions of many who were thought incapable of such sacrifice. These were rapists. These were murderers, guys who had chopped up bodies and put them in a box, you know, that kind of a thing. What did you make of what it asked of people and how they responded, and what was there must have been some pretty compelling stories there.
Well, you know, first of all, when you look at crimes that people commit and end up in prison, it's easy to judge them just by like a momentary lapse in judgment at mm-hmm. one time in their life. I mean, if you were to let the safest felons as far as repeat offenders out of prison, it would be a murderer, because they're less likely than a rapist or an arsonist or whatever to recommit the crime. But the prisoners that were pretty much involved in the rescue and all of that, a lot of them had were in for property crimes. Basically, you know, there was and a lot of them in were for prohibition offenses. Mm-hmm. Some had been in for assault for the most part. But, you could say they were hardened offenders, but they also, felt the obligation to, you know, other prisoners, you know, to do for them what they would like done for themselves. Mm. And, I think that this would happen really in any prison where you had a large fire during this era, or, you know, or at least some type of catastrophe like that.
I think it's significant that you mentioned early on in the program that this was back in the old days before the gangs. I covered the Lucasville prison riot 30 mm-hmm. odd years ago, and I know what you mean. That changed probably the trajectory of the whole thing because of the gangs, because it was so siloed.
Well, my most recent book that I just finished is on a world history of prison gangs. And, there's some overlap looking at prison culture in the 1930s and comparing it to the prison culture after the 1960s, mm-hmm. where, you know, there's a lot less segregation in the prisons. You know, the demographics have changed, and the power of the inmates. There's a power vacuum that the inmates have filled to a great extent in overcrowded prisons, where, you know, in most regards, they actually run the prisons to a certain extent.
Hmm. Carl in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Carl.
Good morning. I thought I would add to it by saying that there was another fire in the prison set in by the inmates in the 60s or 70s, mm-hmm. and I watched it from the top story of Columbus and Southern Electric Company building, and there were three different places where it was ablaze, and that was a riot of sorts, and it went on for some good period of time, weeks, I think. It was a problem, and a lot of other things went mm-hmm. along with it. But since the prison is not there anymore, people today don't realize how big it was.
Yeah, you know,
it used to run from the railroad tracks down to Spring Street and from Neal Avenue up to,
I remember when Buck Reinhart, the former mayor of Columbus, took a wrecking ball to it, and then that got... Someone put the kibosh on that. It was state property. It wasn't city property. Yeah, lots of riots post that event. How long was the prison around, Mitchell Roth?
Well, it was initially in a couple of other different places, but it was, you know, where it was at that time was from basically the mid-19th century, if you're looking at the nucleus of the prison. Mm-hmm. And what typically happened is they would add on to the prison and... I believe when it closed in the late 1970s or early 1980s, it was being used for other things. I think it was used as a psychological mental ward and, mm-hmm. and for administrative purposes and that sort of thing.
Carl, thanks for that call.
Can I add to what Carl said?
Absolutely.
You know, the fire actually, even though, you know, we hear about these fire disasters, you know, fire is very common in prisons. And that's why, you know, there's always a movement afoot to keep them as fireproof as possible, the prisons and keeping, you know, if you notice when you see pictures of prisons today, you look at the beds and things like that, you don't see any wood. Mm-hmm. It's amazing, cement and steel and that sort of thing. And back then, I found very interesting is a lot of the prisoners had lighters for their cigarettes, and they were able to get this gasoline substance, I think it was called Voldine. Or Volodine, they were able to use that, you know, legally within the prison block. So you had all kinds of accelerants that were there.
A mutiny followed. So this was the fire was put out relatively quickly. It was smoke inhalation that killed so many of the inmates. And then there was a mutiny. You started one chapter with a reporter's words that the Penyard resembled an armed camp after a pitched battle. What happened?
Well, first of all, it's interesting that analogy is used quite a bit, comparing it to a war zone. And a lot of people that make that comparison, you know, probably had served in World War One, which wasn't that long before. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I know a lot of the prisoners that were in there were ex-war veterans, you know, that had fallen on hard times. You know, but the thing is that. There was really a lot of the locks have been broken on some of the prison buildings, but mm-hmm. some prisoners took this as an opportunity in other buildings that were not being threatened to break their locks, to break out and just have a good old time and have some freedom. So they were taking advantage of this. So a lot of the prisoners were forced to leave the buildings until they could become safe and they could lock the doors, and they had to find a place to take a number of prisoners that were troublemakers and hold them until they could fix the prison cells and the prison locks.
Let's see, David and Powell, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Good morning. I have a anecdotal, rather dark story about that incident. My great uncle was the chief engineer at the mental hospital up on West Broad Street, a couple miles away from the fire site. And because of his expertise and everything, he lived on grounds there at the hospital. He called to see what assistance or what he should do to help with the fire. And he called the penitentiary's, director. And the response he received back from them, and he told me the story several times, was let them burn.
What about that, Mitchell Roth? Inmates in prisons had a very different kind of value, even though a lot of people argue that inmates are undervalued today and aren't treated properly. Back then, even worse?
I think, this was a time, where you had relatively high crime rates, or at least the newspapers made it seem like that.
Because of the Depression.
And, you know, and also to come and the Prohibition era as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most people, you know, thought that the prisoners were getting their just desserts and, you know, really did not, you know, sympathize with them that much. And, you know, a lot of the blame was directed towards the prisoners. And this was even before they figured out that it was arson. It was initially they thought it might have been electrical short or something like that. It took a while for that to come out that it actually was an arson.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was one of the big problems.
David, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. It's interesting to hear the old stories. Mitchell in Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Mitchell.
Hi, Ann. Hey, I had a quick question. I wanted to find out if anyone was held financially responsible, if anyone was sued by the, you know, the state or the city or the government for what had happened with the deaths or people being injured.
No, unfortunately, nobody was kind of compensated. Number one, prisoners were much less litigious in that era. You know, they had a lot less access to, you know, lawyers, and you didn't have writ writers and that sort of thing. And because the prisoners started the fire, and, you know, even though that the response to it was totally inadequate, there was really no movement to, you know, compensate them at all.
Thanks, Mitchell, for that call. We are talking about the fire in the Ohio Penitentiary. It's where what we know of as Nationwide Arena today. It occurred in 1930, and it claimed the lives of 320 inmates. My guest is Mitchell Roth. He's a professor of criminal justice and criminology at Sam Houston State University. His book is titled Fire in the Big House, America's Deadliest Prison Disaster. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. On Easter Monday in 1930, a fire trapped hundreds of inmates in the aging Ohio Penitentiary just minutes after they had returned to their cells from supper. What remains the deadliest prison fire in American history claimed the lives of 320 men. They hailed from every corner of the country and beyond. Still with us by Skype is professor of criminal justice and criminology at Sam Houston State University, Mitchell Roth. His book is titled Fire in the Big House, America's Deadliest Prison Disaster. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I just kind of wonder, what came of this? It was the Depression. The people didn't have a lot of sympathy for inmates at the time. They thought they got their just desserts, as you pointed out earlier, Mitchell. But did things change because of this?
Well, that was one of the things that I was interested in finding out. And it really didn't seem like much changed at all in the long run. It typically, whenever a disaster occurs, you know, you have a lot of talk about it, you know, mm-hmm. whether it be a school shooting or whatever. And then basically it's kind of forgotten. But this was such magnitude, you would have think that it had, more influence than it did. It did have some influence. You had different prison systems, like in New York State, for instance, insisting that they have more training, for instance, prison guards. You had more training in firefighting. But it really, it seemed to have a little bit less influence in Columbus. There really wasn't, really much change done to the system at all. Like, you know, and also, too, in the criminal justice system, you still have people being locked up for longer times, and having less ability, to get out for even the most minor offenses. You know, I mean, America's always had a love affair with the prison, and it just didn't start in the recent years.
Carol in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Carol.
And I have kind of a positive story. My grandfather
was the chief electrical engineer at the Penn, and my dad always told stories of when, and one of the major one was that my grandfather had been in his building all the way north boundary of the Penn, and inmates came, and because he had always been kind and respectful to them, they escorted him out of the prison. That was always a family story that we appreciated.
Did you hear other stories like that, Mitchell Roth?
It seems like, you know, the prisoners pretty much respected, you know, most of the people, you know, that worked for the prison system. The only person that they really hated was the warden. And the warden knew this, and that's why he never really stepped into the courtyard until a couple days after the fire had been put out. You know, but the thing is that the prisoners didn't have really any type of animosity towards the people that worked there. And remember, the prisoners weren't, for the most part, had no idea about this fire, what was caused at the moment that it took place. They just thought it was an accident. They had no idea what was going on. And that's, you know, kind of why they would not take it out on people working there. Also, they might have had it in the back of their mind, too, that the death house was right there, too, as well. And they used it in Ohio at the time. So, you know, you didn't want to cross those lines.
Right. The mutiny that followed, how long did that go on and who was behind it?
Well, basically, you know, the mutiny, I guess, you know, implies that it was something that was, you know, kind of well organized.
Right.
It's kind of like a kind of a spur of the moment, you know, for a bunch of, you know, the more troublesome inmates to kind of act out. Most of the inmates went back into their cells, whether they were broken or not, and just sat there, you know. And the only thing they could really do kind of control the troublesome inmates is, you know, not feed them and not give them coffee to a great extent. And since they had destroyed their cells and weren't going to stay in the cells, they created this kind of perimeter fence with a bunch of tents and, you know, forced them to stay in there. And, of course, they ended up setting all the tents on fire. So, you know, that here's another fire going on and, you know, basically, it lasted for, I would say, you know, less than a couple of days. I mean, it was pretty much, you know, started and then it was over. It wasn't, you know, that big a deal to, you know, if when you think of a mutiny, it wasn't,
right.
They weren't taking over the building or anything like that.
The convicts elected a committee of 40. They called it the Committee of 40 for Facts to jumpstart an agenda of reform. Who were those guys and what were they trying to achieve?
Well, they were pretty much, you would call them kind of shot callers, people that were well respected within the prison. You know, there's certain prisoners that were, you know, had a lot more respect than others. And a lot of it dealt with, you know, what their crimes were. I mean, if it was a much more serious crime, that gave you much more, you know, street credibility than somebody, for instance, that, you know, was in for, you know, stealing a cow or something like that. But, you know, they basically were some of the more intellectual prisoners. You have to remember you had, you know, writers that were in prison. You had bankers. I mean, so these weren't all uneducated people. But, you know, there's not a lot of information that I was able to find about, you know, the backstory of all these guys that were in it. And it was very ephemeral, this group, as far as, you know, what they did and what they were able to accomplish. But it was just another attempt at basically, you know, getting the prison under control.
How did you do your research? I guess maybe I should start with the question of what spurred you to this in the first place?
Well, I was working on another book on the history of, you know, crime and punishment in America, and I was working on a book on Texas prisons in 1931. And as I did my research, I'd come across something here and there. And when I came across this fire, you know, with such a large body count, you know, I was amazed. I had never heard of it before because I'm kind of a disaster junkie, I have to say. And, you know, wow, I didn't know about this one. I mean, it was worse than the Chicago City Fire of 1871, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, all these that have tons of books written about them. And when I went to research it, I couldn't find a book. And then when I went to Columbus and started talking to people as I did my research, no one even knew it had taken place. And, you know, I'm a professor and, you know, I talk to my students and they'll often say, well, I wasn't alive when it happened. And I said, well, I wasn't alive when Lincoln was killed. So
right.
I know that. But I was surprised that there's no memorial to the prisoners. And that's why I dedicated the book to them. Whereas if you go to all these other major disasters in other parts of the country, you know, there's usually a memorial somewhere. Even in Ohio, you had a plane crash here, a plane crash there, and, you know, and there's some type of memorial. But it would be what I would like is if some type of plaque could be put in place, you know, near where the prison was, and at least people walking by it would know that, you know, really something seminal took place here.
Yeah, I don't think there, I could be corrected if I'm wrong, but I don't think there's any trace of the prison anywhere in the fabulous Arena District now.
No, it's a shame.
So how did you conduct your research if it was so little was known about it? Although we've gotten some great calls today from people with family memories of it, which has been really cool. But how did you do it?
Where were they when I was doing my research?
Right.
I put out so many, you know, blogs and requests for information, and I did get some responses from some people. I had some information from someone that had actually interviewed one of the people that survived and had a very interesting interview, a transcript from that. But I went to Columbus and I spent a week or so in the archives just copying everything I could find. And the biggest help was the transcript to the trial that followed, you know, basically a day after the prison fire ended, they started a kind of a trial, and they had 44 witnesses that testified, and there's a 742 transcript on, you know, page a transcript, and it, you know, basically has the testimony of convicts that survived, prison guards, you know, all the major actors in this. And so, you know, that was kind of the nucleus of the book right there. But then, of course, you know, I did a, you know, survey of, you know, of newspapers and, you know, secondary material, which was very lacking. I mean, if you look at books on disasters in America, very few of them will list the prison fire.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think it fell into, you know, fell between the cracks that way?
Well, I think to a great extent, you know, prisoners were seen as something, you know, not noble, something, you know, that do not deserve commemoration, or at least during that time period. And I think what's happened, you know, over time, I think if something like that was to happen today, that there would be some type of memorial and there would be much more outcry and sympathy. But I think people just, you know, wanted to get on and kind of forget about it. And and since it's kind of fallen between the cracks of, you know, local knowledge, I mean, if they don't know about it there and, you know, nationally, no one knows about it really, you know, there wasn't going to be much of a, effort to, you know, to remember the tragedy. But I think a lot of it has to do with who the victims were in the prison.
I thought it was pretty cool that you had in the appendix the list of the victims, their age, their race, their marital status, their occupation, their place of birth, and the crime that they were convicted of, and their term and their date of birth. Why did you do that?
Well, first of all, you know, as sometimes we complain about the internet and all of that, I was able to get all the death certificates of all the prisoners from one of the local historical societies online. And I thought, you know, that this is important information. Number one, it humanizes the victims to a great extent. And I think that's very important, that they were very different people. Some were married, some weren't. And it also I found some other types of documents that talked about, you know, the experiences, military experience of the different prisoners, the religions and so forth. I mean, it was a very... you know, a very interesting, you know, group of prisoners that you had there from all over the world. I mean, the American prisoners are mostly from the neighboring states. They're either from West Virginia, some from Tennessee, Kentucky, and Ohio. So there wasn't a big difference between them. But I just thought, the reader or someone who's interested, you know, would maybe find this very helpful in understanding the prison fire a little bit better. And also it would be, you know, for people looking for family or whatever, they might be able to. I've come across a few people that, you know, basically said they had relatives that died in it or were injured in it. And but they really didn't know a whole lot. I think, you know, sometimes these family stories get passed down and, you know, they kind of get exaggerated with age.
Whatever happened to all the bodies?
Well, what they did is they took them over to the horticulture center. They have a fairgrounds that wasn't too far away. So they took the bodies over there in these trucks. And when they brought them over there, they laid them all out, and they had they were embalmed over there. Local undertakers and local funeral homes donated coffins. They donated flowers and things like that to, you know, make it kind of, respectful, you know, going away. And typically the bodies were returned to their hometowns. And, the vast majority of them were returned or claimed by family members. I mean, family members were there very quickly once they heard about the fire, thanks to, you know, the radio and everything. You had people at the gates trying to figure out, you know, whether, you know, a relative was alive or dead and that sort of thing. So anyway, most of them were, crated back to their hometowns. You had some that were put into like paupers' graves where, yeah, you know, no one claimed the bodies. And then because of segregation, you had African-American victims that were buried in African-American cemeteries locally. But the interesting thing is you had a very small number of African-American victims compared to the rest of the population, showing the demographics, you know, in prison of the time period.
The Warden Thomas, how did he patch things up with the inmates, or what happened to him?
No, I mean, basically, life didn't get any better for him. There was a lot of calls for him to step down, even though, there were his supporters. I found all kinds of letters written for him and against him in the archives in Ohio. Everybody had, you know, their different opinions. But he basically was suspended for a period of time, not a real long time. And I think in 31, he was back at the job on a, mm-hmm, temporary basis. By 1935, he had basically resigned from the whole prison system. And in his last few years, there was kind of an organized crime figure whose last name is Licavoli. He was a Cleveland kind of mobster.
The Purple Gang.
And, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And there were some scandals that perhaps they were getting some favor treatment from the warden and from the assistant warden. And so, you know, I deal with that a little bit at the end. But, it was pretty well documented, that there were some payoffs going on, and, you know, these things happen, you know, in prison systems. But, he didn't really gain any type of respect in the community. He wasn't going around talking about his experiences. The only places I heard him, found him that he spoke was like at the National Penal Congress when they would have that, and he would talk about, you know, what happened there, trying to give information to, you know, other wardens around the country. But again, his career, you know, was kind of on the decline as it was. And this, you know, that basically, you know, catapulted him outside of the prison with the rest of his family. Was, you know, his wife and daughter lived with him on campus, if you want to call it a campus.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, too, is his daughter actually had a lot more acclaim than he did, his daughter Amanda. And so, you know, she was supposedly, you know, kind of helping, get the correct help here, calling for, you know, support, you know, issuing weapons and things like that. But ultimately, it turned out that she got a lot of pushback when it turned out she was having the inmates basically try and rescue all of her furniture from her apartment, afraid that they were going to burn up. And she kind of, as a peripheral player, but she got a lot of attention in the newspapers at the time, just, you know, because, you know, gender, you know, hear of women being involved inside a male prison. And one of the things, too, is you had an incredible response by nurses and doctors and, you know, all kinds of people from the area. And it got to the point where there were too many doctors, coming in, and you had a lot of members of the clergy coming in. It was, Columbus really should be proud as a city for, you know, how it responded to this.
And yet it was forgotten, but not anymore. Mitchell Roth, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Mitchell Roth is a professor of criminal justice and criminology at Sam Houston State University. His book about this great fire is titled Fire in the Big House, America's Deadliest Prison Disaster. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for all those great calls. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.